Rabbi Landa did most of the legwork here, so I'd like to thank you for putting this together and welcome you again to this conference. We're going to have several different sessions here today. Just to briefly give you an overview, we're going to be talking about three strikes, punishment in the American and Talmudic legal systems. Then we'll be talking about mental incompetence in the Jewish insanity defense in Jewish law, the ethics of compromise, when is arbitration appropriate, and then assisted suicide, Jack Kevorkian in the prism of Jewish law. So I think we have an exciting afternoon ahead of us. The first speaker is Yitzhak Reidowitz. He's an associate professor at the University of Maryland and rabbi at Woodside Synagogue in Silver Spring, Maryland. He received his rabbinical ordination from Ne'er Israel Rabbinical College in 1976, his J.D. magna cum laude from Harvard Law School in 79, and a doctorate in Talmudic law from Ne'er Israel in 1992. He has lectured extensively throughout the United States and Israel on such issues as medical business and family ethics. He has published articles on bankruptcy, commercial law, medical ethics, family law, and halacha. He authored a survey article on the brain death controversy in Jewish law, published in Jewish Action, and is presently completing an article on the status of pre-embryo in Jewish law to be published in the forthcoming issue of Tradition. I welcome him here today, Professor Yitzhak Reidowitz.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here again. I was here at last year's conference, and I hope that this will become an annual event for the Jewish community. The first topic I'm going to be discussing is entitled Three Strikes, Punishment in the American and Talmudic Legal System. And basically, it's going to be kind of an overview of what we might call the criminal justice system under Jewish law, and drawing some comparisons to the American system, and discuss what lessons we might be able to derive from that comparison. When we look from a secular perspective, and we try to identify what are the purposes of the penal system, basically judges, commentators, philosophers have identified, I think, what might be regarded as five different values that might be served by one or the other type of punishment. One of the original goals of punishment was said to be rehabilitation. The very word penitentiary, or the big house for the jail, comes from the word penitence. It has a notion of a religious symbolism that will send off the bad person for a prolonged period of isolation, minus a color TV, where they will reflect upon their lives and repent and ultimately come out as a better person than they were before they committed the offense. I think we have to concede that although this has been a theoretical goal of the criminal justice system has totally failed. In that respect, when we look at the recidivism rates, and we look at the fact that very often people emerge from the prison system in much worse shape, emotionally and spiritually, than they were when they entered, by and large, rehabilitation is still stated to be a goal of the system, but it's a goal that is virtually never achieved. A second purpose of criminal sanctions, and many would say this is probably the predominant purpose, is the notion of deterrence. Now, deterrence itself breaks down into two subcategories. There is what is called general deterrence, and there is what is called special deterrence. Special deterrence simply means that if you're off the street, by definition, at least for the duration that you're off the street, you will be disabled from committing the crime. We put you away for life, hopefully. The person would be permanently disabled. And therefore, special deterrence refers to the impact of the sanction on the offender himself or herself in terms of their ability to repeat the crime. In that sense, of course, the death penalty is the ultimate special deterrence, although there's a lot of debate whether it deters other prospective offenders. It certainly will stop this person from doing it again. That is special deterrence or specific deterrence. We then come to general deterrence, which is the much more difficult measure. That is the concept that by having a system of punishments, any prospective violator who is aware of the possibility of that punishment might thereby be dissuaded from committing a crime that would otherwise be committed. And many judges And I think the general public, by and large, views the ultimate goal of criminal punishment should generally be to make society safer by providing some notion of general deterrence to stop people from violating the law. A third, or a fourth, depending if you count the general and special deterrence as one thing or two things, but a further value is often said to be retribution. And retribution means the understandable need of society to express its collective rage at those who violate its sacred norms. It is almost instinctive on a mass collective level to cry of revulsion that certain evil we have to say is so abhorrent to our consciences that we need to take vengeance. Now again, I'm not yet addressing whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying that it is a reality of life that within society there is often a strong streak of vengeance that needs to be vindicated. Now, when we start asking, you know, when we look at Jewish law, now Jewish law does have a very extensive criminal code. Now, much of what Jewish law would regard as criminal behavior, however, is not limited to the interpersonal relationship, but does include what you might regard as purely religious or moral offenses. For example, when there was a temple, when there was the Davidic monarchy, and you look at the Torah's laws, we find, for example, the desecration of the Shabbos, violating the sanctity of the seventh day, was a capital crime. Together with murder, together with adultery and the like, these were capital offenses. And as is characteristically true for the Jewish legal system when it existed in its entirety, and I'll discuss what part is still applicable today and what part isn't, there is very little distinction between what we would regard as offenses against the religion and what we would regard as offenses against the person, because all of this is part of God's law, and therefore all of these are criminal violations, as it were, which create a punishment. But before I get into the specifics, if we were to ask, what are the values that the Jewish criminal law system is trying to advance by virtue of its punishments, we can make a number of observations. Number one, rehabilitation does indeed assume a certain role in Jewish penal theory. This is not true for every punishment. Obviously, when you have a capital offense and you put somebody to death, we're not dealing with rehabilitation. However, let me give you one example. Generally speaking, imprisonments was not a commonly employed sanction in the Jewish legal system. For example, for theft or burglary, the penalty was primarily restitutionary in nature, as opposed to any type of imprisonment. For things like murder, for desecration of Shabbat, or for adultery, it was the death penalty. So you basically vary between a death penalty is one type of sanction, restitution is another type of sanction. We also have something called lashes, which meant certain violations of the law. One could be whipped 39 times. I remember a few years ago, Michael Fay in Singapore, the young boy, I was going to get, I think, 8 or 6 hits on the backside. And then I was thinking, well, gee, Michael Fay is very lucky that he didn't live in the time of the temple where you can get 39 lashes. But if we survey the general system of punishments in the five books of Moses as amplified by Talmudic law, we do find capital crimes, and we do find restitutionary and punitive fines, and we do find lashes. But we don't really find the concept of imprisonment, as you say. There is no specific reference in the five books of Moses to imprisonment except as a form of pre-trial detention. The one reference in the criminal code, so to speak, in the concept of imprisonment involved a person who blasphemed the name of God. Moses did not know what the punishment was going to be. So the Pasuk says they put him in jail until God told them what the appropriate punishment would be, which happened to have been stoning. So jail, imprisonment as a final punishment, is not explicitly mentioned in the five books of Moses. It is simply a mechanism for what we would call today some type of pre-trial detention while guilt or punishment is being determined. However, there is one institution that may furnish a model for a modern theory of penology, which is not denominated as a jail, but perhaps could give us some guidelines as to what the ideal imprisonment system would be. And this is a very interesting institution called the Ir Miklat, the city of refuge. in which it's worthwhile to ponder what that is. Biblical law, and the Talmud goes along with this, differentiates between what we would regard as intentional homicide, what we would call murder, malice aforethought, which is a capital crime, and unintentional homicide, which we could paraphrase and essentially call manslaughter. As far as I understand it, halacha does not differentiate at all between first-degree murder and second-degree murder. The only dichotomy would be between murder, which is intentional killing of another human being without justification, and accidental or inadvertent, which would fall under manslaughter. Murder, per se, is a capital offense under Jewish law. Again, I'll amplify this as I go on. But unintentional homicide is a very, very interesting punishment that the Torah mandates. The Torah says that the unintentional perpetrator, right, I'm lowering the piano and the piano chain breaks and I kill somebody, or I back out of my driveway and I didn't look and the child ran in the back of the car and got run over. These are unintentional homicides, which do have to involve a certain element of negligence, because if there is no negligence, one is exonerated totally, but negligent but unintentional homicide. There is an institution called a city of refuge that's throughout ancient Israel. There were actually 48 different cities to which the perpetrator was supposed to go, and he was to remain there either for the duration of his life or until the death of the high priest, whichever came first, and he would remain in that environment. And if he ever left the protective confines of the Ir Mikvah, of the city of refuge, the Goel Hadam, the blood avenger, which is the closest relative of the victim, would be given carte blanche, would be given a license, as it were, to shoot the person, to kill the person. That was the incentive to keep the perpetrator within the confines of the Ir Mikvah. Now, what was this Ir Mikvah? So this Ir Mikvah was essentially something similar to a form of house arrest. You weren't in jail, but you were confined to a particular city, and you were not allowed to leave that city for any reason. And if you did so, there was, in effect, a bounty upon your head. The Goel Hadam would either be permitted to kill you, or according to some opinions, he would even have a mitzvah to kill you. It's an argument in the Gemara. Now, what was the Ir Miklat? So the Ir Miklat is the closest institution we have to a prison. The Ir Miklat, each of the 48 cities of refuge, were actually cities of Levites. The Levites lived in those cities. If you remember, the Torah tells us that the Levites were not permitted to own territory in the land of Israel except for these 48 cities. The Levites were the spiritual teachers of the Jewish people. They were people who devoted their days not to commerce or to agriculture or to politics, but they devoted their days to the study of Torah and the divine service of the temple. And the commentaries tell us that the institution of the Ir Miklat was designed to create an atmosphere which encouraged reflection. It encouraged intensive Torah study. It encouraged contact not with the dregs of society, which is exactly what the prison experience is, but with the spiritually elite of the society, who could raise a person's consciousness, who could raise a person's spiritual goals. Now you might ask the question, well, gee, if this thing was an accident anyway, so why does the person need this spiritual rectification? But the answer is, as I say, that in order for any type of homicide to create this liability, there has to be an element of carelessness or negligence, perhaps even approaching an element of recklessness, that distinction that lawyers are very familiar with. And therefore, even though the homicide itself may have been unintended, it did evidence a certain element of disregard for human life. And therefore, the Torah says it certainly does not warrant the death penalty, but it does warrant exposure to those paragons of virtue that the Levites represented. So it's been said, I believe, Lubavitcher Rebbe, of blessed memory, did draw the connection that although commonly we do not describe the city of refuge as a prison, because the person is in the city, he can walk around and do what he wants, but in effect, it does approximate the concept of the penitentiary as, going back to its original meaning, the place of repentance, the place of reflection, the place in which we take the person who showed a callousness for life and we expose him to the spiritually elite of society in the hope that this could create a true rehabilitation and the appreciation. And it's been said, therefore, that perhaps if we still take the idea of rehabilitation seriously, and I'm not sure if anybody does anymore, because the prison system is doing a terribly bad job of it, particularly in the juvenile justice system, where once the child enters that system, the chances are very great that the child is going to be lost for life. That basically is almost an irretrievable detriment to the child. But if we look at the year Miklat, this would encourage society to increase not necessarily the amenities of the prison, because that might be something we don't need to do more of, but the educational opportunities, vocational aspects of it, encouraging senses of responsibility. And the year Miklat could indeed be a very useful model in the direction of rehabilitation. So that's one particular lesson where we can look at the year Miklat as perhaps the model of rehabilitation in the prison context. Let me emphasize that, as you would expect, the Yer Miklat had some very special rules about it. That is, the Yer Miklat were open to anybody. Even the Blood Avenger could go and visit the Yer Miklat, but weapons were not allowed. There were very strict gun control, weapon control rules in the Yer Miklat, etc., and for very good reason. And of course, this would correspond to various proposals to have mandatory drug testing and weapons testing in prison now. And unfortunately, sometimes we've turned into such a rights-oriented society, and there's a whole branch of law dealing with prisoners' constitutional rights, that we might find some cases down the road saying that weapon searches in prisons might be unconstitutional because they're infringing constitutional rights of privacy. I mean, I doubt we'll get that far, but these claims are already being raised. I saw some advance sheets where there are actually cases being brought where prisoners were claiming Eighth Amendment violations, cruel and unusual punishment, because the peanut butter was a little stale, and because they had to have strawberry ice cream for 3 days in a row. And these are cases for which cert petitions are filed in the Supreme Court. They're denied, but the petitions are there, and somebody has to read them and go through them. So you see that perhaps we're moving a little away from the ultimate purpose of the penitentiary. If we come to the second goal of punishment, that is either specific or general deterrence, we see very, very clearly that the Torah articulates in a number of places that deterrence is a basic goal of the criminal justice system. The Torah mandates, particularly in capital crimes, something that may strike a discordant sound to the modern ear, but it does require that if a person has been executed for various offenses, the body be hung up in a public place. Now, it's immediately taken down. It is not left there overnight at all. In fact, it goes up and it goes down. But people should see the body of the person that was executed. And the reason, this is called kalia, hanging, and the reason that is given is specifically b'chol Yisrael yishma'u v'yiro, that all of the Jewish people should see, and they should have a sense of fear not to cross that unacceptable boundary. The notion of deterrence, of seeing the execution on some level, or at least seeing the aftermath of the execution, was said to inspire deterrence. So the notion of deterrence is certainly a major feature of the Jewish penal system. I'll discuss shortly whether capital punishment is a deterrent or is not, but certainly the Torah itself identifies deterrence as one particular value. We come to retribution, that society's need for revenge. And the question is, does the Torah legitimate the concept of societal revenge as simply getting back at somebody because they did something evil? So here, there's a little bit of controversy whether societal revenge is considered to be a legitimate thing for society to do. You know, we have the debate in modern society as well. Some people say for the state to kill murderers to revenge the evil that they did makes the state and makes us murderers doing the same type of thing as that person did. Well, here, I think there would be a difference in approach between those who just read the Bible and don't accept the Talmudic interpretation and those, like myself, who believe that the Bible can be understood only in light of the rabbinical interpretation. If you read the book of Exodus literally, we of course come across the lex talionis, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, which clearly seems to be stating the notion of retribution, vengeance, and revenge. He who knocks out one person's eye, his eye shall be knocked out. He who knocks out one person's tooth, his tooth shall be knocked out. So if you read the verse in Exodus in a literalistic sense, we seem to be seeing a vindication of the concept of societal vengeance. However, I'm sure as you know from prior exposure, the Talmudic tradition is very, very definitive that the verse in Exodus, an eye for an eye, was never meant to refer to taking out someone's eye, but rather it refers to compensation and restoration. That is to say, if I knock out somebody's tooth, I compensate that person for the value of the tooth. If I knock out somebody's eye, I compensate that person for the value of an eye. Again, damages are assessed in a manner that is somewhat similar to how a court would assess damages today for loss of limb or the like, in addition to pain and suffering, compensation, all sorts of things. The point is, therefore, that whether an eye for an eye stands for vengeance or whether it stands for restitution and restoration depends on whether you take the verse literally or whether you understand the verse in accordance with the Talmudic understanding. Certainly, if one goes through thousands of years of how Judaism understood that verse, it is absolutely clear that we have always understood that verse not to refer, as often Christian readings would have it, to literally knocking out someone's eye, but rather it establishes a great principle of compensation. Now that really does two things at once. That reinterpretation does two things. It eliminates vengeance as something which is societally desirable, and it also enshrines another principle which I think is very much absent in the American penal system, and that is it enshrines the notion of compensation and restitution, which we would now subsume under the victim's rights issue. We all of us know that one of the gaping holes in American criminal law, obviously every state is different in this regard, but as a generalization, one of the historical problems in American criminal law was the inadequate attention it paid to the rights of the victims of crime. For example, for many, many years, for most of our history, if I committed a crime, if I vandalized your property, I might go to jail for 20 years, but there was no obligation at all that I make some type of restitution. That was a separate civil matter. The expense of bringing that proceeding would be on the victim's family. They'd have to bring a suit. And even if somehow they got a successful judgment, they have to enforce the judgment, and with exemption laws and concealment and everything else, the guy that was in jail for 20 years for arson would not be very likely to have to really pay anything towards the victim. We should emphasize that in Jewish law, one of the major criminal sanctions is primarily a restitutionary one. For example, what we would call crimes against property, or even crimes against person, for assault and battery, non-homicide. Assault, and, well, I shouldn't say assault, but it's battery. There is, as far as I understand, no real halachic liability for assault per se, but for battery, for vandalism to property, for theft, for burglary, for armed robbery. As I indicated before, the primary sanctions that the Torah places for these crimes are not imprisonment at all, but the penalties, if you look at the penalties, are restitutionary, including a punitive element. Very simple example. This is all from the book of Exodus. If I steal $100 from your wallet, so the Torah says, I got to pay you the $100 plus a punitive fine equal to 100% of the amount stolen. If I steal $100, I got to pay you $200. So it's kind of a punitive damage award. It's a criminal fine, but note that unlike a criminal fine in the American system, which would typically be payable to the government, this is a criminal fine that is actually payable to the victim. So in effect, the 100% penalty would be a right that the victim would assert. Torah goes further. If I steal, for example, your ox, which was something that you needed for farming, and I slaughtered it, or I sold it, I disposed of it, so there's actually a 400% penalty. If the ox is worth $100, I got to pay five times that amount. I have to pay $500, so $100 principal and $400 penalty. I steal a sheep and I sell it, it's a 300% penalty, so for the $100 I pay $400. The point is that I want to make basically is that certainly when we're dealing with crimes against property, we're dealing with battery or personal injury crimes, which in the American system are handled on two different levels. There's the civil level of court law, which is the victim's own responsibility, and then there's the criminal sanction, which is the state's responsibility. Jewish law collapsed the two. And with respect to both the compensatory elements and the punitive element, the punishing of the criminal for deterrence or for whatever it is, the emphasis was primarily on the protection of the victim, rather than either enriching the state or seeking punishment. So it's a very ingenious system in the sense that you're combining both the aspect of punishing the wrongdoer and protecting the rights of the victim. You're doing it in one fell swoop. We are punishing the person, but we are punishing the person by enabling some type of restitution to be paid to the victim. I will say that my suggestion does break down, and I'm going to throw this out as a question. Even rabbis don't have the answer to all questions. Perhaps we can get further enlightenment later. I will say that the system breaks down a little bit for homicide, and that is because Jewish law does not allow recovery for wrongful death. Meaning to say that if I commit a homicide, if it's unintentional, I go to the city of refuge. If it would qualify as murder, it could be a capital offense. But by and large, I owe no monetary responsibilities to the state. And I throw that out as just a question to ponder, and that is, if I break somebody's legs, the obligation is full restitution to the victim, including pain and suffering damages and the like. If I kill them, ironically, the halacha, because of various technical halakhic principles, I only get the sanction for the manslaughter or for the murder, and there is no restitution. So my thesis that the penal system is largely protective of victims' rights does raise a certain difficulty in the area of homicide, which needs further thought, but for the purpose of intellectual honesty, I didn't want to share that particular little problem with you. Let me emphasize, too, as I said before, that there's a lot of agitation now for tort reform and putting ceilings on pain and suffering awards. There's an act going through Congress, which Clinton has vetoed recently, to put a cap on pain and suffering, particularly in medical malpractice areas. And it's interesting that although halakha does recognize compensation for pain and suffering, that's part of what a victim is entitled to recover, it limits pain and suffering to intentional torts and not to negligent torts. Very, very fascinating point. If I negligently injure someone, I do have full compensatory liability for loss of limb, but pain and suffering liability requires intent. Now, that's a very fascinating analog to medical malpractice cases, because medical malpractice cases, by and large, do not involve intentional torts. And hopefully the doctor didn't cut off the wrong leg on purpose. But you're generally dealing with negligence. So in effect, halacha would be supportive of limiting pain and suffering, limiting pain and suffering liability, or at least imposing caps on negligence. And indeed, this would be particularly true in the medical malpractice area, where the Rishonim and the medieval commentators have already pointed out that if you make the liability of a medical provider too heavy, you will be encouraging them to leave the profession. This was a thought that was actually identified in the 1200s, exactly the debate that is going on today, of driving practitioners out of the field. Okay, so basically what we've looked at so far is that at least certain aspects of the penal system do further rehabilitation, particularly the fascinating institution of the city of refuge. All punishments are designed to create a system of deterrence. The Torah specifically articulates this in capital punishment, but it can be assumed that deterrence is a goal of all punishment. We have also said that the Talmudic understanding of an eye for an eye is not based on retribution or vengeance, as you might think if you read it literally, but it is based on a much higher notion, I would think, a much more moral notion of reimbursement, compensation, trying to make victims whole. Let me emphasize that there is one other aspect of punishment which is unique to Judaism and has no analog in the secular tradition, and that is the concept of atonement. Obviously, because of the separation of church and state, it would not be within the purview of a judge to say, may your stay in prison atone for all of your sins, because atonement is the need to spiritually rectify one's soul. We still have a little bit, I'm surprised nobody brought a 14th Amendment challenge when they sentence people to death. They say, I don't know if they say it here, but in some states they say, may God have mercy on your soul. Are you allowed to say that? I don't even know why. Or the Supreme Court of the United States still says, may God have mercy on this honorable court. And may God protect this honorable court. Someone said you should add the word from. You got to protect from this honorable place. Be it as it may, you can see that the separation of church and state, even in the United States, is not as complete. God we trust in money, of course, is not as complete as some secularists would want it. So that's something we'll talk for another time. But certainly, it is not within the purview of a judge or a district attorney to talk about punishment or imprisonment as being a penance for the soul between one person and God. I will say, though, that the Supreme Court, I believe, decided a case, was it 2 years ago, about the constitutionality. Someone was convicted for a crime and then they became legally insane afterward. That'll be addressed later. And there was a discussion whether it was constitutional to punish somebody when they're in a state of insanity. And one of the grounds why it was held to be unconstitutional was that punishment is supposed to serve the purpose of giving the criminal the chance to effect penance. And there was a religious idea mentioned in terms of the purpose of the punishment. I should emphasize just to correct the misconception. It is sometimes believed that in ancient Israel there was something called a debtor's prison, which means if you didn't pay your debt, you could be imprisoned or sold into slavery. That is not true at all. If one didn't pay a debt, that was not a crime at all. The person simply had a remedy of trying to collect on a debt. However, if one steals and one is unable to make restitution, there is an institution where a person can be sold essentially as an indentured servant for up to 6 years and work back in theft. But this was not imprisonment, and this is not even slavery in the sense that we use the word in American history. In fact, the Talmud talks about he who buys a Jewish slave has bought a master for himself, because if you only have one pillow, you have to give it to the slave. Essentially, this was nothing more. I mean, listen, the slavery of a Jewish slave was nothing more difficult than people who work in an office from 9 to 5. So essentially, it just meant you were under contract for 6 years to work for the person, and the person had to support you. So it was called slavery because that was not the common economic arrangement at the time in which most people were independent contractors, so to speak. But the truth is, being a slave just meant you were a wage earner for those 6 years, with a lot of obligations that the master had. So you'd have that aspect, but that really does not correspond to imprisonment, nor does it correspond to slavery. Now, let me move into a different aspect of this, because the title is Three Strikes, and I do want to address the issue of the habitual offender. But before I get to that, there's a little more background that we need to discuss, and as I want to discuss a little bit about the judicial procedure that applied in the times of the temple as interpreted by the Talmudic sources and the like, and in particular the judicial procedure for capital cases, because it's very, very instructive, and there's some interesting comparisons between Jewish law and American constitutional law. First of all, if you read the Torah, one of the first things you'll discover is that a lot of things seem to be capital offenses. Not just murder, but also adultery, even if it's consensual, not just rape. Idolatry is an offense, such as homosexuality, or at least I should say the practice of homosexual sex, not being a homosexual, but the practice of the act, was a capital crime, etc. So if you read this, you get the impression that it was very easy to do something for which you could be executed. And yet, the Talmud explains that if you go through the procedural requirements for the imposition of a capital sentence, they are so rigorous and difficult to meet that the Mishnah makes the statement that a Sanhedrin that executed somebody either once every 7 years, according to another opinion, once every 70 years, was called a bloody Sanhedrin. Because in practice, these punishments were virtually never employed. Let me go over just some of the procedural requirements. First of all, in order to sentence someone to death, this is also true for the imposition of lashes for lesser offenses, you needed a court of 23 judges. That's a very large court. This is 23 judges on the trial level. Let me emphasize that by and large, the ancient system of courts in Israel did not really have formalized appeals. Basically, the decision of the trial court was by and large final, and capital crimes required a court of 23 judges. There was a requirement which ruled confessions of guilt inadmissible. If I walk into court and I say, I murdered, the halakha is very, very clear that my confession was totally inadmissible. I want to emphasize, this goes well beyond the Fifth Amendment's privilege against self-incrimination. The Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination gives me the right to decline to testify. However, if after being given my Miranda warnings and assuming that my confession was voluntary and assuming I was told I had the right to remain silent and I waived my Fifth Amendment privilege, both under common law and under American constitutional law, there has never been a principle that has excluded confessions from evidence, assuming that they're both voluntary and the Miranda warnings were given. By contrast, Jewish law does not merely give a defendant a privilege against self-incrimination, but it in fact rules that his confession is totally inadmissible. At first glance, again, I want to emphasize, this is true only for criminal punishment such as capital punishment. In civil litigation, such as tort cases and even theft, well, this is this interesting dichotomy. If I say, for example, I admit that I stole from you, so we split it up into the civil and the criminal component. With respect to the $100 that represents restitution, my confession is binding. With respect to the extra $100 of penalty, which is really, we call that the criminal function, I don't have to pay. This creates incentives for people to come forward, because if the witnesses convict me, then I got to pay you $200. $100 for restitution and $100 for penalty. If, on the other hand, I come forward of my own accord, I have to make restitution because a civil admission is binding in civil litigation, but in effect, I get amnesty from the penalty, so we do have that distinction. Now, why do we have this rule that says confessions are totally inadmissible? So it's interesting that there are two, again, ultimately we don't have a final reason, but there are two different reasons that different commentaries give. Maimonides gives the reason, because a lawyer perhaps might resonate with you. Maimonides gives the reason that all confessions are inherently unreliable. Maimonides writes, because there are many crazy people in the world who love to confess the things that they never did. And therefore, how can we put somebody to death because of their confession? Again, it's very, very fascinating. Maimonides wrote these words in the 12th century. But as you know, whenever there are unsolved serial murders around, there are people that we know will always call up and claim credit for it to get their 15 minutes of fame. And this is exactly the case. There are many leads. Police don't even bother checking. Somebody calls up and says, I murdered these 30 people. The police will just hang up and say, they're not even bothered to get. He calls up every time somebody gets killed. this guy calls up and takes credit for it. So that's one issue. Unreliability of a confession. There's another reason, again, these are just speculations, but there's another reason that has been suggested, which really goes to a very interesting parallel to the basis of Miranda itself. If you go back to the Miranda case, in which the Supreme Court said that confessions are inadmissible unless you give a person warnings, you have the right to remain silent, etc., and the person waives intelligently and knowingly, waives the right to counsel and waives the Fifth Amendment privilege. One of the criticisms of Miranda is that, number one, it can be administered as a formality, but the coercive effect is still there. In other words, imagine a situation, the suspect is taken into a room and there's this bright light shining on his face, and the police, you know, administers the Miranda warning, kind of a quick mumble, and the person hears that. And of course, even if you have a situation where no coercion is being administered, there can be an atmosphere of coercion that is very, very scary. So for example, the police can pat a service revolver. Just pat it, not say anything about it. Or there could be a rubber truncheon that the cop is always handling. In other words, there are many intangible factors which create coercive atmosphere, which cannot be pinpointed with any type of police brutality. But it can nevertheless scare a person into confessing into things which they perhaps did not really commit. Or, to put it another way, if we go back to the exclusionary rule, well, let's take a different aspect of this, right? It's been a long-standing feature, although the Supreme Court is moving away from it a little bit, that evidence that is obtained in violation of a Fourth Amendment prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures is inadmissible in a trial. Now, going all the way back to Justice Benjamin Cardozo, Cardozo claimed that was an illogical rule. Because Cardozo said, just because the constable blundered, should the criminal go free. Right? And to the general public, the exclusionary rule is still very outdated. It's one thing to say people have rights, but if the police violate the right and they find the murder weapon or they find the drugs, should the person go free? I mean, one could argue, like, one shouldn't automatically follow from the other. But if you look at why the Supreme Court adopted the exclusionary rule over 30 years ago, you will see that it was basically to deter police misconduct. That if the police know that if they violate somebody's constitutional rights, they'll still have the goods on them, then you've created no disincentive against their, or no incentive against telling them not to do so. So in order to deter police misconduct, it was said you have to have an exclusionary rule. Well, some have applied that analysis to the Jewish law rule, which precludes the admissibility of confessions. And that is to say, if confessions were admissible, we might have been creating an environment where coercion would be encouraged. But if a confession is inadmissible, the police or the law enforcement entities get no benefit by coercing people to confess because their confessions are going to be inadmissible either. So one could look at this rule as a prophylactic rule to prevent coercion and wrongful assault on people, because essentially we remove the benefit. But that's, all right, but be it as it may, whether the reason goes to unreliability or whether the reason goes to be a prophylactic against coercive law enforcement behavior, one of the characteristic and unusual rules of the Jewish legal system is the absolute inadmissibility of confessions in criminal cases, whether they involve capital crimes, or even if they would involve lashes or the like, although, and even monetary penalties, although confessions are admissible with respect to civil liability and the like. Second rule is Jewish law does have something akin to the double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. Now, double jeopardy itself is a quite complicated provision. There are many, many subheadings and the like. As you know, one of the cases the Supreme Court will be deciding is the constitutionality of license revocation for DWI cases where the person can also have criminal, in other words, is a license revocation coupled with a criminal sentence. Is that a double jeopardy? But let me just mention that there are two prongs of double jeopardy that have exact parallels in Jewish law. One prong of double jeopardy, of course, is once you've been acquitted in a criminal case, you cannot be retried for the same offense. Right? You cannot have a conviction following an acquittal. That is exactly the principle in capital crimes under Jewish law. Once a Beit Din has adjudicated the person to be innocent, they cannot retry the case, that case, even for newly discovered evidence or the like. So that form does have a parallel, and that is not true in civil litigation, just as is, that is not true under secular law. The second aspect of double jeopardy is the prong of not having two punishments for the same offense. The rule that if one commits one criminal act, one cannot have two distinct punishments. That is also true under Jewish law. There are many, many cases where let's assume that someone commits, well, let me give you an example. Let's assume that on Shabbat I shoot an arrow. I kill an animal on Shabbat. So the problem is, killing an animal on Shabbat is a crime for which the capital sentence could be imposed. But since you killed somebody's animal, there could also be monetary liability. And basically, the Talmud teaches us that if one criminal act gives rise to both capital punishment and monetary liability, the lesser is subsumed in the greater, and only the greater penalty can be imposed and not the lesser. So these are two different prongs of double jeopardy. One is, once you've been acquitted, there cannot be a conviction, and the other is, you cannot have multiple punishments for a single criminal act, and that is mirrored in the principle of the greater including the lesser. Okay, so we do have a double jeopardy analog. We do have a privilege against self-incrimination, which is the inadmissibility of convictions. Perhaps the most unusual requirement is that, at least in capital crimes, the guilt of the accused must be established by eyewitness testimony, not circumstantial evidence. And by eyewitness testimony, we have a very high definition. There have to be at least two witnesses, which, by the way, finds its analog in a provision of the Constitution of the United States that does say convictions of treason do require two witnesses. Not that you take it from the Bible, but the Bible would apply it to all types of criminal liability. The two witnesses must be Jewish. The two witnesses cannot be related to each other, nor can they be related to the victim or to the perpetrator. They must be halakhically observant, Shabbos observance, kosher observance, and the like. And the Talmud says they actually must see the act being committed. And there's a famous example that the Mishnah gives. If witnesses see a person running after somebody with a knife, and then the person and the pursuer run into a building and they're obscured from view, and the witnesses come in and they see the guy with the knife dripping with blood standing over a dead corpse. So a minute ago they saw him chasing the victim, and now they see a bloody knife or a smoking gun over the body of the victim. Not good enough. Because maybe when they got into the building there was a scuffle, and maybe the victim took the knife away, and therefore maybe the perpetrator killed in self-defense. They didn't see. And if they didn't see it, we cannot draw inferences as to liability. So eyewitness means eyewitness. In fact, according to one opinion, Rabbi Akiva takes the position that he would never impose capital punishment for murder because he argues there is no such thing as an eyewitness. Let's assume I see you stick a knife into somebody's heart. How do you know there wasn't a hole in the heart there from before? The person would have died anyway. Rabbi Akiva takes the position that there's never enough evidence for a capital conviction. And one of the other rabbis said to Rabbi Akiva, listen, Rabbi Akiva, if you would be under Sanhedrin, you would increase the murder rate because you've eliminated capital punishment as a deterrent. So that issue about the rarity of rights, and the debate basically is, Rabbi Akiva's position is, it mirrors the contemporary debate. How can you ever put somebody to death? You never know for sure. That's one side of the debate. With all of these safeguards, you never know for sure. The other side of the debate is, yes, but if these punishments function as deterrents, there has to be a certain percentage of the time that they're going to be applied. If they're never going to be applied, then in what sense can they be said to be deterrent? So this is a debate in the Mishnah. But eyewitness does mean eyewitness. No circumstantial evidence, right? So O.J. Simpson would have gotten off in the Sanhedrin because even DNA matching is not considered to be the same as eyewitness testimony. The only eyewitness was the dog, probably, and the dog is not a kosher. A kosher witness. And finally, there is a doctrine that in order to establish premeditation, the person has to be warned before they commit the act. Warned. They have to be told right? The person's pulling the knife, raising the knife, we have to tell them, don't do that, this is a capital crime. And the person has to acknowledge the warning by saying, yeah, I heard that, but I'm going to do it anyway. Because if he doesn't acknowledge the warning, he could claim he didn't hear it. Or, if he acknowledged the warning, but waited more than 5 seconds later, he could say, well, it slipped my mind, I don't have a good short-term memory. So he has to hear the warning, acknowledge the warning, and act immediately. Right, this is called hasra. This is called warning. So in effect, when you take all of these, oh yes, and besides that, each of the witnesses was cross-examined not by lawyers, but by the judges. And if there were any discrepancies in their testimony, even of a non-material nature, that was enough to throw out the case. But at the same time, if the stories were too alike, that was taken as evidence of conspiracy. In other words, if they recounted the story in the exact same words, because they need transcripts. So you see over here that if there are discrepancies as to what color tie the victim was wearing, that could invalidate the conviction. But if they said things in exactly the same sequence, in the same order, that was already a suspicious circumstance. So we have a system, therefore, in which many, many crimes have capital punishment. But if we ask procedurally, when would this ever be imposed, the answer would be next to nothing. Because when are you ever going to have this thing? I mean, listen, how often are you going to have a murder that's committed in front of, you know, two Shomer Shabbos rabbis anyway? That's not where the murder is going to be committed. Right? It's going to be in a bar, whatever it's going to be. Right? So, by and large, we would have to say, therefore, that capital punishments, and this even some of this is even true for the lashes aspect of it also, would be a fairly rare occurrence. And this is why the Talmud remarks, once in 7 years, once in 70 years, Rabbi Akiva says never, right, etc. Now, as a philosophical matter, you might ask the following. If this is true, then what on earth are the penal objectives that are being served? If the concept is we want there to be deterrence, and deterrence normally is predicated on the fact that people know there has to be certainty of punishment. If in fact the murderer is going to get off, then where is the deterrence that's built into the system? And there are two short answers to that. One is religious, and that is the following. That if one believes that ultimate justice is dispensed only by human institutions, then indeed there's no deterrence. In other words, if the only punishment the murderer is going to get is the punishment that this court is going to give the murderer, then in effect, if there isn't going to be punishment, the murderer gets off scot-free. But to a believing Jew, ultimate justice is God's. And therefore, the concept that the murderer gets off is not a true statement. The murderer may not get the punishment that a human court administers, but that does not mean anyone ever gets off. In God's ultimate justice, there's always going to be reward and punishment, sometimes in this world, sometimes only in the next world, but it is going to come. And to a religious believer, therefore, the concept that evil gets off scot-free is just not a true statement. Second of all, we have to recognize that one of the purposes of law is not merely punishment, so to speak, but it's also an articulation of the moral values of a community. And that is, when the Torah says we're doing A, B, and C, there's capital punishment, the point is not necessarily that we're going to kill the people that do these crimes, but by articulating the severity of the standard, that impresses on the consciousness of the adherent to this belief system of the heinous nature of these offenses. See, that's why, by the way, this gets into another debate. That is, there's a lot of talk, again, this is the talk for another time, but I'll just throw it out just to illustrate what I mean. There's a lot of talk whether we should decriminalize certain offenses which are commonly not prosecuted anyway, such as should adultery be decriminalized, or even casual marijuana use, should it be decriminalized? And people say, gee, you know what, it's tying up resources, the police don't prosecute anyway. But you see, the counter-argument is that criminal law also expresses moral values of the community. Even if the police are not going to break down somebody's door and prosecute them for adultery or bigotry, that doesn't mean you should legalize it. Because there still ought to be statements in society that certain conduct is regarded as evil, even if people habitually break it. And lahavdil, I mean, I don't want to compare the secular law to the Torah law, but in effect, the capital punishment rules in the Torah are similar in the sense that they don't necessarily suggest punishments that are going to be imposed, but they suggest a moral outrage and a moral standard which demarcates the heinousness of the crime, and that itself has a deterrent effect for people who have consciences and people who have moral sensibilities and people who believe in God. If one doesn't believe in God, then indeed it may not have that particular effect. But the Torah speaks to a believer. The Torah does not speak to a non-believer. And as a result, they do their job, even if the capital punishment is very rarely employed. However, having said that, I see I'm running out of my time. I'm about to begin the main point of my remarks. And that is, having said that, it's very important to recognize that the judicial system as articulated, or as practiced by this Sanhedrin of 23, is only one particular track. Just as for hundreds of years, there were separate law courts and equity courts in the common law of England until they became merged into one system. Delaware still has separate chancery courts. The truth of the matter is, there are alternative tracks in Jewish law which are not necessarily subject to the same procedural restrictions. It was well recognized, even in Talmudic times, that if you had a system where criminal punishment had so many procedural niceties that had to be met, that as a practical matter, the criminal would go free, this might encourage, in some environments, a sense of lawlessness, making people feel very insecure in their homes and in their personal safety. And as a result, the Sanhedrins, or the melech essentially is the synonym for the government, would be able to revoke some of these procedural protections and impose punishments without all of these rules. Now again, who makes this decision is a little shrouded with uncertainty. Sometimes there are references to courts making the decision, but even then it's not really clear. Are we talking about the trial court, the 23-member court? Or are we talking about the Supreme 71 court? Was this done on a national level? Or was it done locally? Is it done on an ad hoc basis, such as martial law? Or could this be a permanent change for a high crime area? In other words, there are a lot of unknown questions, because the point is this. The Talmud spends many, many pages describing the ideal system, and only a few lines giving us hints as to these alternatives. But there is some evidence that indicates that for much of Jewish history, the alternative systems were in use more often than the pristine systems. And just to articulate the principles, there is a principle that is called Beis Din, Makim, Vionshin, Shalom, and Adin, that a Beit Din, a court, a religious court, when it had criminal powers, could punish and impose sanctions, even in opposition to those mandated by the Torah, in order to preserve the public order. There's also something called Mishpat HaMelech, the king's justice, which referred to the ability of the Melech to suspend procedural rights to punish criminal offenses. I should also emphasize, Rabbi Landau mentioned the Noahide Code. The Noahide Code is very interesting. Judaism says Jews have 613 commandments, but Jews also teach, the Torah teaches, the Talmud teaches, that there's a universal code of humanity that is binding on all people. And these are called the seven commandments of Noah. Let me just, because they were given to Noah after the flood. And of course, all human beings are descendants of Noah. Let me just mention what they are. They are not the same as the Ten Commandments, although there is some overlap. Prohibition against idolatry, which is again religion. Prohibition against blasphemy. Prohibition against theft. Prohibition against murder. Prohibition against adultery and incest, various sexual offenses. Prohibition against severing a limb off an animal when it is alive. We could generalize that to refer to cruelty to animal law. And finally, a commandment to establish court systems which will administer justice in a fair and equitable way. As Rabbi Landau commented, that is why when an attorney practices his or her trade with honesty, they are actually involved in the furtherance of this Noahide commandment. Being an officer of the courts and furthering the cause of justice is a religious imperative, even if you're not operating under Jewish law, because you are fulfilling this Noahide imperative. I should emphasize that Jewish law has different evidentiary requirements for Jewish courts and for the so-called Noahide courts. In a nullified court, circumstantial evidence is admissible. In a nullified court, one witness is good. You don't need two witnesses, and they don't have to be Jewish. So if we go back and we ask, would O.J. Simpson get off under Jewish law? We have to be a little bit more sophisticated in our answer. If he would be a Jewish defendant who would be tried in front of the Sanhedrin, O.J. Simpson would have gotten off, because you don't have the eyewitnesses, nor do you have the warning. But if we ask, what would Jewish law say about a trial court in California, which would operate under the Noahide Code, indeed, according to many we've shown him, the Noahide Code does admit of circumstantial evidence, and DNA is generally a fairly highly reliable predictor, and it would be. So it's a much more complicated analysis. What does Jewish law say to Jews who are governed by the Sanhedrin, or what does Jewish law say about non-Jews who are governed by the Noahide Code? The final issue I want to mention, and I'll mention very quickly, is the three strikes and you're out issue, the issue of habitual offenders. Is there any concept that if you keep on doing the crime, at some point we throw the book at you and either we impose capital punishment or at least lifetime in prison? You know, there was a case a few years ago, I think it was either California, Texas was an early state that had a three strikes and you're out, mandatory life sentence for felonies. And that can turn into something I think we would regard as unjust. There was a fellow who basically stole a pizza. And because the pizza was over $10, so that already constituted a theft that qualified as a penalty. And his two other felonies were writing bad checks for a total of a $25 overdraft. And he was sentenced to life. He sought review of his sentence on the ground that this was cruel and unusual punishment because of the concept of proportionality. The punishment was totally out of proportion. And Justice Rehnquist, chief writing for the courts, as you would expect, did sustain the constitutionality of that sentence because he said, three strikes and you're out means three strikes and you're out, and it is not unconstitutional, even if it's only for stealing a pizza and writing a bad check for $25. What does Jewish law say about this? Jewish law does, in fact, have one provision that deals with habitual offenders, but only in a very limited context. It does say that if somebody committed an offense for which one gets the statutory penalty of lashes, an example would be if one ate ham. And again, let me emphasize, this also required the warnings, the witnesses, this required all of those procedural niceties. So it's very difficult to do. But if he got his 39 lashes for eating the ham sandwich, and then he eats the same ham sandwich again, and gets those lashes. So when he eats the ham sandwich, it has to be the same offense the third time. Since the lashes no longer have their deterrent effect, there is something called the kippa, which resembles imprisonment under a very severe deprivation. The way the Mishnah describes it, he is given bread and water, kind of shrink his intestines, and then he's given barley that puffs up when you soak it in water. That the suggestion seems to be that will actually cause his death. Whether that is a mandatory punishment or whether that is a discretionary punishment is a matter of discussion in the commentaries. You have to be very careful, because sometimes we read these things and we assume that is what the court must do, and that's how I always understood it, but I just read yesterday, I was looking at different commentaries, and I saw that some commentaries say it is within the court's discretion to impose such a sentence, but in fact that is not something that very happy. In addition, this discretionary sentence can be used in cases of even one-time homicides where there is factual evidence that the person committed the crime, but there are minor discrepancies. In other words, the two witnesses have different versions of what socks the victim was wearing, so you can't convict them under the law of the Sanhedrin, but some have said that this alternative imprisonment with the bread and water might be available as well. The point that I want to leave you with is, therefore, that although we have a pristine description of an idealized system,